The point is that the socialization of black people in this country was such that until very, very recent times, the notion of direct physical aggression against the perceived oppressor was not a notion that was lightly entertained. Nevertheless, it is true that black protest has been a continuous phenomenon of the white over black arrangement ever since its inception. Eventually, selected passages in the Bible came to provide a religious rationale for what had already been learned by experience. And the line between practical behavior and scriptural requirement became increasingly fuzzy and eventually disappeared altogether. But resistance at some level never ceased. But the prevailing philosophy eventually was a philosophy that placed deliverance in God's hands and protest in God's name, but God's most effective instrument was always the man who felt that he had to be free, free to worship God and free to belong to God. Now, in addition to looking to God as the deliverer, and in addition to conceiving himself as God's instrument for the deliverance of God's people, there was also a closely related syndrome to the effect that the white man was not essentially evil, that he was essentially moral, and that it was only a matter of being able to bring forcibly to his attention the suffering of black people before the white man would do something noble about it. The rationale was that whites were Christians, and blacks learned their Christianity from whites. That whites were rational beings, and the mistreatment of blacks was an irrational kind of practice. That good must eventually triumph over evil, and that this is in the very nature of things. That it was a matter of miscommunication in most cases. That the white man honestly believed that black men preferred benevolent subordination, and that if only he could be convinced that they did not, that he would change his behavior toward them. Or that it was a matter of temporary subordination that was required as a principle of convenience, and that when the temporary convenience had been served, then the white man would change in his attitude and in his behavior toward blacks. In short, throughout the whole period of slavery, and long after slavery for that matter, there was a reservoir of essential belief in the essential morality of the perceived oppressor. And many blacks attempted in various ways to excite this latent moral principle in which they believed with indifferent success. The feeling still continues, particularly in the South, where even today it can be heard put in various ways, that the Southerner is still likely to be the black man's best friend now that we have gotten over the legal hurdles that separate black people from white. Speaking of legal hurdles, there was always a strong belief in judicial deliverance. And again, the rationale went something like this, that mankind is one, and the United States Constitution is addressed to the liberation and the protection of all men, at least of all who qualify as citizens, and that being born in this country and participating in its development and in its security made all blacks birthright citizens, the illegal practice of slavery and segregation notwithstanding. That the 14th and 15th Amendments clarified a pre-existing right, and that the law rightly adjudicated and fairly enforced could solve all of the problems of racial oppression. But judicial deliverance was slow and uncertain, and worse than that, it rested ultimately upon that same moral sensitivity, or lack of it, that we mentioned before, because the same whites sat on the bench and ran the courts and enforced the law to their own convenience and selectivity, and their convenience was the continued existence of a black undercaste. Finally, we come to the institutionalization of something called nonviolent protest. A nonviolent protest was, in the first instance, an attempt to tap the wellsprings of Christian morality and to wash away an evil that profaned the faith and divided Christians into racial groups. A nonviolent protest was an attempt to communicate to white Christians, to white America, the considered intent that black America would have its manhood, must have its manhood, but was still willing to suffer even further to have that manhood within the parameters acceptable to our common faith. A nonviolent protest was an invitation to white America to be done with racist practices or run the risk of compounding a morally indefensible and outdated anachronistic position by trying to defend and to preserve what was indefensible and what did not deserve preservation. A nonviolent protest was the determination that the cover should be blown from the cozy rapprochement between racism and the Christian church, and that the vicious practices engaged in under various and sundry guises of acceptability should be exposed for what they were. Nonviolent protest was an agonized decision to involve a generation of children, black children and white children, in the fight to the end that ignorance, or the claim of ignorance, should never again be either a cause or a cover for the viciousness we have practiced and accepted. Few black children will take exploitation for granted in the future, and few white children will assume the exploitation of others as a right incident to their color. Finally, a nonviolent protest was the supreme expression of the reaffirmation of faith in the ability of man to suffer the existence of his neighbor, to believe in the accountability of his neighbor, to challenge himself, and to challenge his neighbor to participate together in the restoration of community, in the absence of blood, and in the presence of love. Nonviolent protest was a way of saying, "Thou art, but I am, and let us be together." And so today is the birthday of Martin Luther King, the first and possibly the last apostle of nonviolence to a generation which found him to be insufferable and which in characteristic fashion removed him from the scene. Thank you. There's a little irony in the fact that because this lecture will perhaps be a little bit longer than the previous ones, it happens to be the one where I've also lost my voice. However, I am told that the Army can fix anything. So Captain DeVoe has gone to find something to fix my voice. The question is whether or not what he finds is going to be solid or liquid, or whether it will be legitimate. I had promised to talk to you this morning about the black church as a social institution. I think rather I want to broaden that title somewhat and simply talk about the black church, transcending in part what I had expected to say about the institutionalization of the church. Religion, like law, is by its very nature and by the ultimate implications of its meaning for its practitioners, not expected to register change with every shift of the wind and the ongoing life of the community. Indeed, it is the stability of religion, its tradition of endurance, its transcendence of the social flux, which enables men to find in it the security and assurance that they need to rescue them from the meaninglessness of change qua change. I want to preface my talk with that a little bit of a statement because of the fact that we are witnessing currently some very sharp changes in the meaning of religion, and particularly in the meaning of religion as it has to do with the black practitioner in America. When the invisible church, that is the old slave church, which used to worship in the swamps and the bayous far, far from the big house, sang of that old-time religion, its reference was to a kind of religion remembered for its faithfulness and its consistency. It was a religion which had been tried and proved worthy of the testimonials of time. Yet there is something anomalous about religion. Religion does change, and religions do change. The change may be superficial before it is finally structural and systemic, but change does take place, And in religion, change mirrors the social flux, which is to suggest that changing religious values may be a fairly accurate index of new perceptions men have about themselves and their relationships, as well as of the new anxieties which are always generated by change itself. Enduring religion endures, as it was meant to, transcending the flux and integrating the totality of experience by which human life is gauged and evaluated. But it is the nature of its endurance that gives religion its characteristic reliability. Religion alone has the ability to address itself effectively to what is new and evocative while retaining the assurances of what is subtle and traditional, appearing at once to change with changing institutions and to persist through change unaffected by any history but its own. Yet to understand the religious history of a people is to know quite a lot about their politics, their social habits, their hopes and aspirations, their fears, their failures, their understanding of who they are and what life holds for them. A close reading of the history of medieval Europe, of colonial America, is a revealing commentary on the whole history of these eras and the personalities who illustrated them. In societies where the common religion is acknowledged as a total way of life, as in the case of Islam, or of classical Judaism, or of certain African religions, all history is read and interpreted through the perspectives of religion and of believers and non-believers alike. The projection of history interpreted through the prism of religion can be a powerful device for the accentuation of group consciousness and for distinguishing those who may be heirs to the promise from those who are mere obstructionists to fulfillment and who for that reason will have to be dealt with. There is no fire, no zeal, to compare to that which derives from one's personal religion rightly understood. Countless wars, pogroms, jihads have been carried out in the interpretation of the requirements of the faith. Dissenters have been beheaded, revisionists have been burned, unbelievers have been fed to the carnivorous, kept handy for the purpose. And while contemporary religious commitment is usually thought of as too sophisticated or too attenuated to command such aggressive assiduity among the faithful, the primeval memories are never far from the surface of concern. The tragedy of contemporary Ireland is a case in point. The establishment of modern Israel and Bangladesh, although enormously complicated by international politics, economics and military considerations, may be well counted as corroborative evidence. But in the United States, the black Muslims are feared and suspected by some sections of the population, and even a movement like Key 73 has excited the concern of some segments of the Jewish community who see its proselytizing zeal as a threat to the Jewish interest in the religious cultivation a reclamation of the religiously non-committed within what the Jews consider to be their traditional private cultural province. The point is that a society or a community that is religiously alert will invariably react to whatever may be perceived as a religious innovation, because whatever is new is perceived as an implied threat or contradiction to what has already been settled by history and confirmed by tradition. The innovators seldom see their new doctrine or practice as innovation, but are quite likely to find its justification, or even its roots or requirements, in precisely that old-time religion to which all parties appeal as jus canonicum. To retrace our steps a bit, It would be difficult to define America as religiously alert without some statement of qualification. Alertness can take two forms. There can be, in the case of religion, an internal alertness which addresses itself to the quality of the expression of faith, and there can be an external alertness which functions in a groundskeeper's role with no concern other than to stave off intrusion and the violation of the premises, although the estate itself may be in near ruin from internal decay. This preoccupation with territoriality has been a major bar to church union at a time when most American denominations can only point to a diminishing impact and diminishing returns despite the maintenance of traditional denominational and territorial prerogatives. There seems to be no necessary relationship between territoriality and spirituality, and serious exploratory ecumenical dialogue is silent. When a leading Jesuit seminary announced its desire to relocate, two leading Protestant seminaries were so competitive in their invitations to the Catholic institution as to delay an actual decision for several months. One interesting result of this new kind of rapprochement between Protestants and Catholics was its probable contribution to the extraordinary phenomena of John Kennedy, an Irish Catholic, being elected 35th President of the United States. I know that you are wondering what I'm going to talk about the black church, but all this is sort of necessary as a prelude. Never before had the Protestant establishment allowed its liberalism to be quite so unrestrained. By the end of the 60s, nine Protestant denominations had joined COCU, Committee on Church Union. But the drive toward church union foundered badly in the early 70s as more and more Protestants, fearing the loss of their traditional independence and perhaps of their identity as well, found denominational merger less and less attractive. In the first place, all of the merger which did in fact occur brought together logical groups already in the same theological or historical tradition. There were no mergers which brought into a single communion groups holding widely disparate confessional positions. After the more obvious mergers were effected, suddenly it seemed that a united front against communism was somehow less compelling than before, and perhaps the restoration of the broken body of Christ might not necessarily require, quote, a slavish uniformity, close quotes, in belief and practice among all true believers. Individuals have different tastes and requirements even in religion. The Presbyterian groups, now united with each other as the Presbyterian Church USA, withdrew from COCU in 1973. They did go back, of course. But the hope for meaningful church union in the United States was, of course, already badly undercut by racism long before the general disenchantment with the movement had set in. Although three black Methodist denominations were eventually committed after some elaborate concessions to protect them from discrimination were offered by the white constituents, none of the three black Baptist conventions ever affiliated. None of the black communions would ever be likely to be comfortable with any plans which would exchange their autonomy for white control and direction. Black Christians have had a bitter experience with religion in the white man's church, and that experience transcended slavery and freedom alike. Wherever white Christians and black Christians had come into contact with each other in America, black Christians had been demeaned by the white man's presumption of racial superiority. in their own churches and their own denominational structures, black Christians had become accustomed to a sense of dignity and self-fulfillment impossible to even contemplate in the white church in America. So the black church created its own literature, established its own publishing houses, elected its own bishops and other administrators, founded its own colleges and seminaries, and developed its own unique style of worship. Because black individuals themselves have been frequently unsure of their identity, and because the black church is itself a creature of the countercurrents of American racial proclivities, the black church has not always been unambivalent in its understanding of what it is and why. At times, it has seen itself as a less perfect counterpart of the white church, striving for parity and perfection. This self-demeaning undervaluation made some Negro churches more white in their ritual behavior and their social attitudes than many of the white churches they sought to emulate. Black ministers with Scottish Presbyterian accents, now comes the liquid. Thank you. Black ministers with Scottish Presbyterian accents. The distribution of church offices on the basis of skin color. The effort to exclude from worship services every vestige of so-called Negro music or Negro emotionalism have at times illustrated the uncertainty the black church has had about its role and its function. On the other hand, the black church has been much maligned for being black, for being a nigger institution. Its deficiencies and shortcomings have been magnified with little effort on the part of its critics to see beyond the politics, the maladministration, and general insufficiencies by which it has been characterized. The implications have always been that whatever the shortcomings of the black church, they could somehow be removed or ameliorated by getting rid of the stigma of blackness. If black Christians could only be somebody other than themselves, what fine people they would be. Their churches would look better, their ministers would be better educated, their programs would be more efficiently administered, and of course, people would respect them more if only they would stop being black. To be or not to be is not the question. The black church decided 2 centuries ago that it had to be and how it had to be. Now it has been pushed by fate and circumstance into deciding what to be. One of the leading architects of the developing black church was Martin Luther King, Jr. King's contributions to the moral and the political experience of America are enormous, and they transcend his more incidental relationships. Yet, in the context of American tradition, King's relationship with the black church could scarcely have been incidental. Although fame and recognition took him eventually to the far corners of the world and gained for him admission to places and presences unavailable to lesser men of whatever color, when he left Boston University to offer himself to God and man, despite his excellent education and preparation for the ministry, despite his eloquence, despite his high moral character and his promise, there were no doors open to Martin Luther King except black doors. He belonged to the black church whether he would or not. And when the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church of Montgomery summoned him, Dexter was symbolically and prophetically the black church summoning her own. Even a decade later, when Martin Luther King has won the world's acclaim, including a Nobel Prize, and even as various movements were hailing him as hero sans color, a leader for all the people and for every cause, so far as American Christendom was concerned, his blackness was not transcended. From Riverside in New York to St. Peter's in London, he spoke from the pulpits of many famous churches, but he knew, and those who heard him knew, that when the last amen was said, his brief mission had been concluded. One of King's biographers writes that among the dozens of offers he received following his successful leadership of the Montgomery boycott was the pastorship of a large northern white church. But there is no indication that King ever took such an invitation seriously, for when he left the Dexter Street Church in Montgomery, it was to return to Ebenezer Baptist in Atlanta, the black church in which he was raised and nurtured. He belonged to the black church, and in it and for it he lived and he died. Now it was Martin Luther King who made the contemporary black church aware of its power to effect change. King was certainly not the first black clergyman to be a leader in social action. The history of the black experience is replete with the names of such preacher activists, from Nat Turner to Adam Clayton Powell. But King, first as the leader of the Montgomery Improvement Association, and later as founder and leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was first to put together a sustained coalition of Christian leadership at the pulpit level. In Montgomery, King, as King himself put it, his task was, quote, to be militant enough to keep my people aroused to positive action and to be moderate enough to keep this fervor within controllable and Christian bounds, close quotes. His method was a strategy of Christian love. Love your enemies, he said. Let no man pull you so low as to make you hate him. If you will protest courageously and yet with dignity and Christian love, when the history books are written in future generations, the historians will have to pause to say, there lived a great people, a black people, who injected new meaning and dignity into the veins of civilization. This is our challenge and our overwhelming responsibility. Close quotes. While it must be left to history to determine how much dignity the American civilization has been able to retain after several years of Martin Luther King's rather revolutionary application of Christian love, the black church took on dignity of leadership and the posture of martyrdom, which is the traditional penalty for serious leadership in civil rights. In Montgomery, the black church sought to convince a Christian society, long committed to white supremacy and black subjugation, that love and patience and sacrifice could effect a degree of social change, even in situations encrusted with prejudice and sanctified by tradition. Of far greater importance, before the decade was over, the black church had convinced itself that it had power, a potency it never before even suspected. To understand the power of the black church, it must first be understood that there is no disjunction between the black church and the black community. The church is the spiritual face of the black community, and whether one is a church member or not is beside the point in any assessment of the importance and the meaning of the black church. Because of the peculiar nature of the black experience and the centrality of institutionalized religion in the development of that experience, time was when the personal identity of the black individual was communicated almost entirely through his church affiliation. To be able to say that I belong to Mount Nebo Baptist that we go to Mason's Chapel Methodist was the accepted way of establishing identity and status when there were few other criteria by means of which a sense of self or communication of place could be projected. While this has been modified to some degree in recent times as education, vocational diversification, and new opportunities for non-religious associations have increased, the social identity of the Black American, as well as his self-perception, are still to an important degree refracted through the prism of his religious identity. His pastor, his church, his office in that church, or merely his denomination, are the important indices of who he is. The Black church, then, is in some sense a universal church, claiming and representing all Blacks out of a long tradition which looks back to the time when there was only the Black church to bear witness to who or what a man was as he stood at the bar of his community. The church still accepts a broad gauge responsibility for the Black community inside and outside its formal communion. No one can die outside the Black church if he is Black. No matter how notorious one's life on earth, the church claims its own at death and with appropriate ceremony. The most colorful and protracted funerals in the Black community are often those of non-church figures who, by the standards of some other communions, might be questionable candidates for the unrestricted attention of the church. Because the church is still, in an important sense, the people, and because the church leaders are still the people's representatives, the stature of the Black church was immeasurably enhanced by the Montgomery affair. Not only did the church and the people win a very critical and dangerous contest with the white establishment of the capital city of the old Southern Confederacy, it won the larger battle, which by its own example destroyed the appalling, innovating psychology which had convinced generations of Black people of the invincibility of the white man and the incapacity of Black people to follow Black leadership or to hang together under the stress of white disapproval. The lesson of Montgomery was possibly Dr. King's most fundamental contribution to Black America. For the great boycott that lasted from December 1955 to 1956 helped countless millions of Blacks all over the country to find themselves and to understand more clearly the basic anatomy of white-Black relations. What they discovered at Montgomery was a formidable panoply of myth and taboo supported by the frequent abuse of raw power, which kept Black people intimidated and afraid. The Montgomery experience taught them to discount the myth, to ignore the taboo, and to deal with white power for what it was. It was inevitable that the lessons of Montgomery would be tested again, and that out of each new encounter, there would be produced a proliferated body of experiences which could be drawn upon for the refinement of strategy as the Black church enlarged its commitment to the re-dignification of its people and to the certification of its own relevance. The first child of the Montgomery experience was SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. SCLC was founded in 1957 at a meeting of some 60 churchmen, most of whom were ministers, at Ebenezer Baptist, the church pastored by King's father in Atlanta. King, as you know, was elected president, and SCLC remained his primary base of operations until his death. The nonviolent resistance movement was both instructive and embarrassing to the American religious establishment. It was the perfect example of fundamental Christian ethics being put into practice. But the practitioners were for the most part black, and their strategy of returning love for evil and nonviolent response in the face of indescribable violence was directed essentially at Christians who were white. The unjust laws the blacks were refusing to cooperate with were laws legislated and maintained by a powerful white establishment proud to conceive itself as one nation under God with liberty and justice for all. Now, a few white clergymen spoke in support of the programs of King and SCLC and very promptly lost their pulpits. Others who introduced tension in their churches by attempting to approach the matter from a teaching perspective found themselves, quote, too far ahead of the people, close quotes, and were required to desist from their efforts. Scores of other white clergymen and some prominent white laymen supported the black thrust for freedom and dignity by raising money and by joining the civil disobedience demonstrations, which were eventually to rock the country for a decade after Montgomery. Black and white together was institutionalized in the theme song of the civil rights movement, which began with an extraordinary expression of faith that we shall overcome someday. While many of the white churchmen were undoubtedly acting out their sense of guilt, and others recognized an opportunity for national publicity and some public acclaim for taking the gospel of Jesus Christ onto the firing line for black people, there were cases of extreme sacrifice and extraordinary heroism on the part of white Christians who had nothing to gain and everything to lose. And indeed, some whites and many blacks did lose all they had, which is to say their lives. Montgomery and SCLC showed the black church its potential for power, and it was inevitable that in probing the possibilities for making that potential real, a variety of strategies would emerge, and there would be differences on which programs and policies should be given priority and which ones should be muted or abandoned. First, there was the problem of jurisdiction. There were problems with the NAACP and with the Urban League. In 1962, a faction of more liberal members withdrew from the National Baptist Convention to form the Progressive Baptist Alliance. Dr. King figured prominently in the chain of events which he eventuated in the formation of a new denomination, and in doing so, he earned the public enmity of Joseph H. Jackson, who was long the president and spiritual leader of the National Baptist Convention. Dr. Jackson considered Dr. King to be an upstart, a provocateur, and ultimately a menace to the best interests of black people and to the clerical profession. For Jackson, the proper role of the preacher, especially the black preacher, was to bring the good news of the gospel to his flock, to save the members of his flock for Jesus, and to effect change by exemplary conduct. Dr. Jackson's views were shared by many blacks of his generation, but despite his power and personal prestige, he failed as the image of the proper black Baptist clergyman which emerged from the crisis of the King era. Men like Wyatt T. Walker, Fred Shuttlesworth, Ralph Abernathy, Leon Sullivan brought to the Baptists and to the black church in general a new kind of leadership which hurried along the demise of pacifism in the black church. Leon Sullivan's contributions, while emanating from less dramatic kinds of confrontations than those of Dr. King, were hardly less dramatic and no less valuable to a people seeking power through the church. Sullivan's own words suggest the psychological obstacles he and all black clerical leaders were faced with, but they also illustrate the power potential inherent in the black church. Said Sullivan, although the black preacher has been criticized for what has been called lack of leadership in the colored community, The fact is that without the influence he has exerted through his church, we black people would certainly never come as far as we have. Every movement of significant proportions to survive in the black community has had its roots in the colored church." Close quote. Sullivan, who had been an active supporter of Martin Luther King in his various campaigns to integrate lunch counters in the South, awoke one day to the dismal realization that while the lunch counters of his own city of Philadelphia were not generally segregated, all the people who worked behind those counters were white. What black people needed more than anything else, he concluded, was jobs. The dignity of an integrated hamburger without an integrated quarter to pay for it with seemed a specious dignity indeed. At Sullivan's initiative, 400 black ministers of Philadelphia launched a selective patronage campaign against certain of the worst offending industries which depended heavily on black patronage but refused to employ black workers. Their objective was to end job discrimination against blacks by activating the latent power of the black church and bringing it to bear against the concerted power of big business. Despite the fact that it was outside the South where rigid patterns of job discrimination were normal, the city of brotherly love had a dismal record of black employment. Up to 1958 in Philadelphia, although the black population comprised 1/4 of the city's total, less than 1% of the sensitive clerical and public contact jobs were held by black people. The jobs blacks held fell mostly in the service field and into the most menial categories. As of 1958, in all the banks in the city of Philadelphia, there were only 3 colored tellers. There were absolutely no black salesmen drivers of trucks such as for the major soft drink companies. There were no full-time colored salesman drivers for major bacon companies or any of the ice cream companies or any of the oil companies. There were but a few black clerks in the supermarkets, a few colored sales girls in department stores, and few black clerical and stenographic workers in any of the large offices downtown. Everywhere you went where the jobs were good, you saw white people and you did not see black people. And everywhere you went where the jobs were poor, you saw blacks, and even those black jobs had white bosses. Close quotes. The Philadelphia 400, in this case, a determined alliance of 400 black ministers, brought an end to the more blatant forms of job discrimination by the simple expedience of suggesting to their congregations on Sunday morning that they avoid promoting the evils of discrimination by not doing business with the companies who practiced it. Segregation in the church itself left the black preacher uniquely situated to lead such a campaign and to follow his own suggestions, because none of the managers of the offending businesses were likely to be members of his church or to sit on his board of trustees or even to be known to him, and it was unlikely that he would ever be drawn aside at the end of the Sunday service and to be lectured to by an irate member of his congregation for refusing to do business with a company that did $1 million business in the city. When a company had been visited by a committee of black ministers and invited to hire or upgrade black workers and still refused to do so, the following Sunday, each of the 400 black ministers invoked selective patronage against a particular company, declaring that we cannot in good moral conscience remain silent while members of our congregation patronize companies that discriminate against the employment of our people. For 3 years, the black church was locked in silent revolution. Once the silence was broken by a feature story in the New York Times, so effective was the Philadelphia movement that the selective patronage technique soon spread to Atlanta, Detroit, New York, and other cities. But the ministers in Philadelphia went a critical step further. soon realizing that few blacks were prepared for the jobs now available to them, the black church organized the Opportunities Industrialization Centers, the first one housed in an abandoned jail, where they went on to provide black people with the skills and training needed to fill the jobs that selective patronage had opened up for them. Probably there is more unity in the black church than is commonly recognized. 90%, possibly more, of all blacks in America belong to 5 major communions in but 2 denominations, an impressive record when compared statistically with the distribution in the general church in America. It is useful to make the point of denominational unity here, but obviously unity had to be made across denominational lines. Sullivan and his associates in Philadelphia proved again that the power inherent in the black church is limited only by the lack of sophisticated leadership. And to understand and appreciate what kind of an entity the black church is, and to develop techniques of leadership compatible with the church's understanding of itself and of its function, is the major task that lies ahead. The black church's traditional reluctance to place itself in opposition to the white structure grew out of lessons partly learned from actual experience and partly learned from the vicarious understandings communicated through the projections of actual experience. The two fundamental beliefs contributing to this reluctance were one, the absolute invulnerability of the white man, and two, the absolute vulnerability of all black people and all black institutions. These two convictions, formidable in themselves, were usually buttressed by feelings of contingency and dependence, the recognition that ultimately life itself depended upon the white man's goodwill, his charitableness, or at the very least, his passivity. This was, of course, the ultimate psychological conditioning at which the ideology of slavery was directed, to inoculate the slave with the notion, nay, the certainty, that his welfare, his status, his life always lay in the hands of his master. Hence, the surest security was to behave in such a way as to evoke the master's active goodwill, and the greatest jeopardy was to rouse his annoyance or his displeasure. Deliberate invisibility, whenever possible, doing nothing to attract the master's attention one way or the other, was risky, but certainly less hazardous than open defiance. A fourth conviction had to do with the unreliability of black leadership. Since all blacks were equal in their unequalness, that is, in their social distance from whites, to trust any black leader was to assume the miraculous. Self-hatred left little room for imagining any black man to be able to deliver in any contest with any white man. Black leaders were not as well prepared. They had little or no experience. Worst of all, since all blacks were deprived, black leaders could not resist the pressures to sell out for a little money or for a long title, or so the myth ran. Present in this attitude was the latent assumption that black leadership was a game which blacks could never expect to win. Hence, the real goal of the black leaders was a payoff which would in effect permit them to win against blacks, not against whites. It was viewed as an in-group exercise in futility, but well calculated to produce personal rewards for the leaders, but only frustration or perhaps some measure of catharsis for all others at best. At worst, a foolish or unscrupulous black leader could bring down the wrath of the white establishment
with great suffering and increased inconvenience for those he presumed to lead. Finally, there was a moral aspect to the matter, which has proved very troublesome in the past and which in various forms and guises still haunts the black church. Essentially, it was a question of unfaithfulness to white supporters who in times past were relied upon for such favors they chose to deliver. Charity, philanthropy, intercession, advice and counsel, commiseration, friendship, etc. Tradition has it that black people never forget a favor and never remember a wrong. That is why, it has been argued, black slavery was so successful and lasted so long. Whatever the merits of this proposition, the concern for the sensibilities of white friends has undoubtedly been important in structuring of strategy and the selection or the rejection of leadership in the black community. Similarly, the black church had to deal with the issue of the degree of the white man's culpability. The black Muslims solved that problem summarily by declaring the white man to be totally demonic, totally depraved, a creation of the devil, and the very prince of demons. Hence the Muslims placed the white adversary outside the pale of redemption, a religious strategy calculated to reduce white-black relations to a very elemental level and to simplify whatever questions that might arise as to the Muslims' proper concern for white people. But the Muslims are not representative of normative black religion. The traditional black church was both cautioned and conditioned by its history. It could scarcely be comfortable with the declaration that the very people who brought it the gospel in the first place were a race of demons beyond the scope of God's redemption and excluded from the area of their proper Christian concern. Like all the other elements of the syndrome we are discussing, these attitudes are either in sharp abatement now, or the problems which generate them have been redefined in a way which permits them to be dealt with in the context of black theology, which I shall discuss this afternoon. Yet their significance to understanding the metamorphosis of the black church cannot be overlooked. In summary, it can be said that the black church has often chosen to struggle with the problem of whether to struggle at all with the powers and principalities of this world, and whether such a struggle might not question the righteousness and the sufficiency of God, who in his own way and in his own good time sets all things right. The notion of white invincibility and black vulnerability and contingency, the suspicion of black leadership, the concern for the white man's soul, and for the divine prerogative to initiate change, all add up to a basic inherent conservatism. But it also adds up to a mature religious posture which distinguishes the church from a mere instrument of civil rights or social change. This is a distinction oppressed, impatient blacks find difficult to understand, if not to perceive at times. And it is a distinction which critical whites frequently refuse to acknowledge when the black church does become aroused or involved. But black religion and the church, which is its cultus, does have a moral and ethical concern beyond civil rights, and it does, as indeed it must, confront issues at times at levels in which theological considerations, psychological conditioning, and myth come into play. The leaders who have been most successful in gathering the tremendous latent power of the black church are those who have been wise enough to work with the people through and not oblivious of the requirements of their faith. Such leadership is common in the case of individual churches or cults, and is often attributed to the charismatic attractiveness of a particular minister or cult leader. But charisma is a word that is hard to define, and certainly it has been stretched to cover a multitude of aptitudes not necessarily related to spiritual gifts. In the contemporary understanding of the word, a saint and a charlatan may both be charismatic leaders, distinguished only by what they intend to do with the money. Charismatic leaders come and go, seldom leaving any permanent imprint upon the social fabric which marked their transit. The black churches have had more than their share of such, but effective leadership of the black church requires something more. Although the black church has been the sole nexus of real power, gathered or ungathered in the black community for all its history, black power as a specter to plague the conscience of white America began as a slogan created by the young militants of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, then led by Stokely Carmichael. This was the summer of 1966, and the story of how black power became associated with the black church, which resulted in the issuance of a black manifesto, is perhaps another story that might be told at another time, since it appears that our time is just about over. But I do want to say this.